At times, the line between fiction and nonfiction is tenuous at best. But curiously enough, that situation doesn't always affect a movie's sense of authenticity. Hi, I'm Dan Webster, host of Movies 101. On this week's show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I will discuss three movies that take different paths in an effort to get at some larger truth. The French narrative film aptly titled Nonfiction, plus two video-on-demand documentaries, Framing John DeLorean and Rolling Thunder Review, a Bob Dylan story by Martin Scorsese. So don't touch that dial, because another edition of Movies 101 is coming up next, right here on Spokane Public Radio.
When you hear us say, listener-supported public radio, what are we really saying? Public radio is shorthand for thought-provoking, well-crafted, stimulating programs. Listener-supported means it's your money that pays for those programs. And not only the programs, but the transmitters, the computers, the electricity, everything it takes to bring you those programs. So here's a very large thank you to you, the listener, in listener-supported public radio.
Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokane7.com.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, full-time law professor at Gonzaga University School of Law.
And I'm Nathan Weinbinder, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio and film and music editor for The Inlander.
And welcome to Movies 101, the show that likes its popcorn covered with butter and extra salt. And when the house lights go down, we do our best to eat quietly. That makes for a better experience for all involved, especially when seeing movies such as the trio we'll be talking about this week. We saw one in the theater, the French offering Nonfiction, which is playing at the Magic Lantern, and two in the comfort of our own homes, video-on-demand documentaries Framing John DeLorean and Rolling Thunder Review, a Bob Dylan story by Martin Scorsese. All three, in one way or another, take unusual steps to capture some sense of the truth. Let's begin with a film set mostly in and around the French capital city of Paris. What would a French film be without a lot of eating, drinking, making love, all done while or in between ongoing debates about everything from the future of literature to the debilitating / invigorating effects of social media? Good question. And it's one that French filmmaker Olivier Assayas explores thoroughly in his film Nonfiction, known by its original French title as Double Vie, or Double Lives. Assayas' last two films, 2014's The Clouds of Sils Maria and 2016's Personal Shopper, are just the latest in a career that began in 1979. With Nonfiction, Assayas has given us a film that is nothing less than a comedy of manners, though the laughs are likely to evoke more knowing smiles than outright guffaws. It features a gaggle of friends, business acquaintances, former and current lovers, revolving around two couples, the literary editor Alain and his actress wife Selena, the novelist Leonard, and his political consultant wife Valerie. Alain has never met an issue he won't debate, sometimes from both sides, and Leonard is a writer whose books are barely disguised looks at his own life. Selena plays a cop on TV, a job she thinks is beneath her, and Valerie, the least jaded of the quartet, advises a politician who may or may not be worth the trouble. All in all, Nonfiction is both a commentary on and satire of a certain slice of contemporary life, not just in France, but pretty much everywhere, even as it boasts all the activities expected by anyone attracted to the popular view of French sensibilities.
Nonfiction screened recently at the Seattle International Film Festival, and it did get some sort of mixed response from the cognoscenti, the regular filmgoers there. But actually, I liked this film a lot, and maybe that will be a controversial position, I don't know. I liked the performances. I liked the tongue-in-cheek fun that the characters were making at the sort of world at large. And it had, to me, almost this Shakespearean comedic partner shifting and switching and so forth going on. And it was trying to take on some serious topics, but in a way that I thought was making fun of them at the same time. I loved Juliette Binoche here. There were some things that happened.
Who plays Selena, the TV actress.
Right. And we had been watching the French police procedural Spiral, and I think that she was modeled in some respects after the primary protagonist in that particular French series. But this is a little bit muddled at different points in terms of what is the time frame that we're dealing with. I think it's current time, but that wasn't even absolutely clear. People's paths cross in different ways, but you can't really figure out completely where the alliances are. But I don't know. I was willing to give myself up to it, and I know that others might not. And I do like the French eating, drinking, making love aspect of it, because the film is replete with scenes of all of those things, sometimes all at once.
Yeah, it's true. I think we're going to be talking a lot on this show about the nature of fiction and nonfiction and how fiction can sometimes worm its way into something that's supposed to be nonfiction. And looking at this movie, which is called nonfiction, there's a lot of that going on here, both in the things.
That's an ironic title.
It's about the lies that these characters are telling themselves and each other, and even down to the nature of the novels that one of the central characters is writing, which he's calling autofiction, or it's being described as autofiction, and he's pushing back against that description because these books he's writing are about a novelist with his name and about all the affairs he's having with people that everyone in the public sphere knows he's having affairs with. Mm-hmm. And he's saying, I don't understand. Autofiction, what is that? This is a novel. So there's a lot of that going on in here. But the movie itself isn't as tricky and shape-shifting as some of Assayas's last films, notably Personal Shopper and Clouds of Sils Maria, both of which have a kind of strange, almost supernatural edge to them, and you keep waiting for that moment where the spell of this movie is going to break. And there is one near the very, very end where the fourth wall seems to shatter briefly and then picks itself back up again and moves on.
Well, and also this didn't use some of the same filming techniques. So it's not only the storyline and so forth, mm-hmm. but I think, especially in The Clouds of Sils Maria, there were all these sort of mysterious...
Yeah, that's a very dreamy, cerebral kind of movie.
Exactly.
Even though it's also about, for the most part, two characters sitting and talking about their lives and
changes,
their careers.
So this is closer
in spirit. And I really like Olivier Assayas. This is closer in spirit to some of his older films like Summer Hours or Something in the Air, because it is...
Summer Hours. I'd forgotten about
really
that.
Really good movie.
I loved that movie.
Yeah. This is closer to that. I don't think it's quite as good as that, nonfiction, but it's awfully talky, isn't it? I mean, it's people sitting around and having these conversations about really weighty subjects like digital technology encroaching on print publications, mm-hmm. and about the current political climate and sort of these glad-handing politicians that one of the characters is working with. It's about their various infidelities and mm-hmm. sort of what it means to cheat on your partner. And I don't know. I kind of had a hard time with this too, even though at the same time I was really drawn into these conversations. I think my problem with it is the characters in this movie seem more representative of their individual philosophies than they seem like actual real flesh and blood people. They seem almost like talking points on two legs in a lot of ways. And they're kind of rigid in the things that they think. And I guess that's the point. And Dan, I'll finally let you talk. I'm sorry.
I had only one problem with this film, mm-hmm. and that is the casting of Leonard. I mean, he's this schleppy, balding guy, and he gets to sleep with Juliette Binoche. That's unbelievable. And I think that's a joke. For about the first half of this movie, I went, you know, what is this movie about? I mean, come on. This is like Eric Rohmer, Pauline at the Beach, Claire's Knee. I mean, those are all the famous French films that people sit around and ramble on and on and on and on. And they drink and they eat and... It's what we've come to think of as French film. And I think this is one of Assayas's smarter films because I think he's using that as a backdrop. This is what you expect of a French film. I'm going to turn it on its head here a bit. I'm going to make these people really totally full of themselves. And I'm going to make the joke that the schleppy guy gets to sleep with.
I don't know about that.
Yeah, because I don't know if the joke of nonfiction ever really comes through all that clearly. Like, You almost,
maybe at the very, very end?
Maybe at the end, because I've also seen this movie described as a comedy. And, I mean, I guess it's lighter in tone than something like Personal Shopper, which is this super dark kind of supernatural mystery. But I didn't really find it all that funny. I was kind of focusing all of my attention on following these conversations because they ping pong all over the place.
Yeah.
And it's in another language, so you're reading all the dialogue.
Right. And, exactly.
I'm trying to follow what they're saying and what they mean and what they're feeling, and yet they do feel kind of like – and again, maybe that's the point. They do feel like – not like people, but like, I don't know, TED Talks or something
here's the interesting feature of this, and maybe this is an age or a generational thing to some extent, because nonfiction to me, I laughed at various points throughout this movie.
As did I. And
yeah.
I smiled all the way through the movie.
And I think that it was more reminiscent not only of classic French film, but also of conversations that, you know, used to take place. I don't know what kind of conversations you have with your...
Wait a minute. We've had conversations with him. He's straight out of this movie.
That's what I was going to say. You should like
I resemble
this...
that remark.
You do resemble that remark.
Well, that's the thing. I thought a lot of the characters in this, you're not always on their side, but I think they all have interesting points about the things they believe. So, I mean, one of the big clashes in here is this idea that technology is destroying the industry of print publishing. And this is kind of an idea that we've talked about a lot,
especially with
e-readers becoming really popular however many years ago that was. And the main character here who is in the publishing industry is pushing back against that. He's leaning into the skid in a way, saying, well, if technology is going to take it over, then we need to make print books more of a niche, more of a specialty thing, make them seem like vinyl records. Exactly. And I thought that was an interesting idea. But then along comes the Juliette Binoche character who's saying, well, print is special. And so I kind of enjoyed listening to their conversational jousting.
Well, they do
maybe I took it more seriously than you did.
I think also go back and think. Elaine, the guy we're talking about, who's the editor, even as he's spouting all that stuff, he's bringing in the young digital woman and having an affair with her while he's sitting there eating Palm Fleet. You know, I mean, that was a
great that's hilarious.
Scene.
Yeah,
I thought it was hilarious.
Okay.
You know,
I guess I like my comedy broader than this. I did like this movie, though, because I just like Esaias as a filmmaker and I like his sensibilities.
Yeah.
And
if it's a good filmmaker, you're going to go with him. And I went with this movie, even if it wasn't what I expected. And that was nonfiction. This is Movies 101, and it's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcasts of Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to look at two video-on-demand documentaries, Framing John DeLorean and Rolling Thunder Review, a Bob Dylan story by Martin Scorsese. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio. And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I discuss the French comedy of manners, nonfiction. Let's now move to a pair of documentaries, both of which we saw through our respective home video-on-demand services, Framing John DeLorean and Rolling Thunder Review, a Bob Dylan story by Martin Scorsese. Let's begin with a bit of musical history. Like almost everything involving America's most recent Nobel Prize winner for literature, Martin Scorsese's look at the 1975-76 Rolling Thunder Review, which was dreamed up and organized more or less by Bob Dylan, is hard to pin down. It's no ordinary documentary featuring as many fictional sequences as it does musical performers, the latter of which includes Ramblin' Jack Elliott, Joan Baez, Roger McGuinn, Patti Smith, and Joni Mitchell, not to mention writers such as Allen Ginsberg and Sam Shepard. Yet the film does capture a number of classic Dylan performances, played in venues across the country, and including such powerful songs as Hurricane, A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall, and Knocking on Heaven's Door. Filmed as part of Dylan's Little Scene 1978 film, Rinaldo and Clara, and consisting mostly of film stock that was discarded from that project. Scorsese's documentary, with its own fictional scenes, attempts to be as Sphinx-like as Dylan himself. What works most, though, is the Nobel laureate himself, hiding behind kabuki makeup while wailing at his best behind a wall of superbly made sound.
I'm still kind of wrestling with this movie as both a huge fan of Bob Dylan and Martin Scorsese, and I think their previous collaboration, No Direction Home, is one of the great music documentaries of recent years. And what's so odd about Rolling Thunder Review is that it isn't until near the end of the movie that you kind of start to figure out what he's up to. And it turns out that, because I've talked to many people that have watched this, it's sailing right over people's heads anyway. So maybe you don't ever get to the bottom of what he's up to, because there is some fakery going on here. They're basically fake talking head interviews where Scorsese is either bringing in actors or he's bringing in people, and Dylan isn't on the joke too, to come in and say things that just never happened, but speak of them as if they did.
Right.
And entering these obvious fictions, well, maybe not that obvious fictions, into the history of this tour and into Dylan's own history. And I think what he's trying to do here, and I would estimate that takes up about 10 minutes of this 2-hour and 20-minute film. I think what he's trying to do is comment on the very idea of rock stars as mythical figures, that they're kind of legends in their own mind and they kind of create their own backstories. And Dylan certainly did that when
Absolutely.
He was first starting out.
Yep.
And I think maybe he's trying to puncture that a little bit while also playing along with it. I think that he's also having fun with the idea that concert films in general contribute to that mythos in a way, and I think that's what he's doing. But it feels less like a commentary than it does a gotcha. And even so, as a gotcha, it's not that successful because, as I said, we were having
like
a conversation right before this that a lot of people have completely missed the joke.
Yep.
And so, I don't know, I'm struggling with that aspect of it. What's really great about Rolling Thunder Review, the film, and we should say it's on Netflix right now, is the concert footage mm-hmm. from 1975, 1976. It's the best concert footage of Dylan that I've ever
yep,
seen.
I agree.
Because
totally
he
agree.
Actually seems like he's having a good time.
Yeah.
It's not the kind of above-it-all Dylan we saw in Don't Look Back. It's not the sleepwalking Dylan that we saw in Scorsese's own The Last Waltz and pretty much his entire live career after that, where he seems to be phoning it in a little bit. And maybe he's playing a character here, which I think is kind of part of what Scorsese's trying to get at, but it worked. And the live footage here, which is the bulk of the movie, is the reason to watch the movie. It's really good. And if you're a Dylan fan, it's like a treasure yeah. trove
yes.
of material.
I really liked this. You know, at first, I guess I was unaware of all of the different spoofs, so to speak, that were occurring because I didn't know as much of the history as maybe some others did, although I was privy to a lot of what was going on. And I actually thought that that worked in a strange way and sort of making fun of yourself. I don't know if Bob Dylan, compared to some other people, has engaged in a lot of self-deprecation.
No.
Didn't seem that way to me. Although I still don't really quite understand what happened with the Nobel Prize in Literature, why he didn't initially go and then ultimately accepted it, but
you
whatever.
Know, I have his acceptance speech.
And half of it's plagiarized, isn't it?
Well, I have it bound on my coffee table at home if you want to come over and
okay,
read it.
Okay, good to know.
Yeah.
I would like to see your apartment.
Oh, yeah,
just
sure.
Hint, hint. So the project as a whole, I agree, the priceless piece of it is the concert footage. And the other stuff could be characterized as fluff, but I thought, I mean, I was amused by it for whatever reason. I think that, you know, this film worked for me.
In terms of all those interviews, all right, the promoter is fake. The director is fake. You know, so many other things about it is fake.
The politician that,
the
is
politician,
fake.
It yep. was played by Michael Murphy, the Robert Altman movie, Tanner 88.
Right.
Or
the miniseries.
HBO's
yeah. mm-hmm.
miniseries. Right.
Sharon Stone is real, but not in the role
as far
that
as
plays.
We know.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, yeah. But the one person who is real is Joan Baez. And mm-hmm. everything that she says in this movie is basically stuff that she said all along.
Including in the other Scorsese Dylan documentary.
Right,
yeah.
right. So, you know, Scorsese picks and chooses. It's so unlike him. I had read something about, oh, there's fakery in it. It wasn't until Michael Murphy
Same.
Took that I went,
That's
oh.
when I, yeah.
And then I had to read about uh-huh. it and figure out all the rest of the stuff. So I don't know what the point of that is.
I think if all you took that, it out, I don't think it would change the
exactly,
movie much.
Yeah. All that said, I want to go back and see it again just simply to see that concert footage because
yeah.
Dylan's voice is not the greatest voice that ever sung a song ever, but only he could sing these songs as well as anyone
That's
can.
What makes his voice so beautiful.
It's just amazing. For Dylan fans, Rolling Thunder review of Bob Dylan's story by Martin Scorsese is a must-see.
I mean, for that performance of Hurricane alone, you know.
Yes,
absolutely.
All right, that was Rolling Thunder review of Bob Dylan's story by Martin Scorsese. Let's close with Framing John DeLorean. Falling in line with the other two movies we've discussed this week, Framing John DeLorean, co-directed by Don Argott and Sheena M. Joyce, plays with the idea of how best to get at a sense of truth. While emphasizing the grand scope of their subject, the almost Shakespearean story of a car maker whose reach for greatness included a subsequent precipitous fall, Argott and Joyce inform us of all the failed DeLorean film projects over the years, and maybe just as a way to show how difficult it is to get a handle on the man himself to understand DeLorean's motivations, not to mention his actions, both the unethical and allegedly illegal, the filmmakers here choose to imbue a wealth of news and PR footage with recreated scenes featuring actors such as Alec Baldwin playing DeLorean and Marina Baccarin playing his second wife, Christina Ferrari. Whatever your reaction to those recreations, what may stick with you the most are the images of the car itself, which the 1985 film Back to the Future made even more famous, and the stories told by DeLorean's two children, whose memories are as mixed as is the man's enduring legacy.
I think perhaps this whole notion of interspersing fact and fiction is something that we need to talk about. We need to devote more time to at some point.
It was the theme of the show this week.
Yeah. I agree, because Framing John DeLorean, and of course that name has multiple meanings, mm-hmm. because he did claim he was entrapped ultimately when he was embroiled in this drug scheme to supposedly raise money for his company, and it's also talking about who he was and so forth. But I agree with you, Dan. I thought some of the interviews of the real people were more impressive than watching Alec Baldwin put on his makeup. It would have been a lot shorter if they had excluded those reenactments or recreations. But I'm conflicted about how much that added. And of course, you and I know more about what was happening during that era. And
we lived through it.
And,
yeah.
you know, so he was the Elon Musk of his time.
Yeah.
And, you know, sort of thumbing his nose at corporate America in many ways.
Yeah. No, I'm right there with you, because I think that as a piece of journalistic filmmaking, Framing John DeLorean is really impressive. Just the sheer scope of interviews they have, the number of people and really good sources that they had mm-hmm. is great. And hearing the people that were there at the time wax poetic about John DeLorean, because they all still think pretty highly of him, is a good enough reason to see the movie. And I agree that framing device, with Alec Baldwin, I don't think it adds anything to the movie. I think that, as you said in your intro, Dan, listening to DeLorean's children wrestle with their own feelings about their dad is so much more compelling than watching actors recreate those things. The idea of doing the fictional scenes because his rights would make such a good movie, that's a great idea, but I don't think it pays the dividends that it should. And I think as a documentary, it's fine, but its reach exceeds its grasp a little bit.
No kidding. Here. They could have done a lot more about the making of the movie Back to the Future. You know, they could have mm-hmm. talked about more. And a little known fact, did you know that it was going to be originally a refrigerator?
Yeah, right.
Zemeckis
mm-hmm.
said, hey, how about if we use the DeLorean car? That's an amazing bit of
But Back to the
news.
Future is still a perfect movie.
Yes, in many ways.
Yeah.
Biff. And that was the documentary Framing John DeLorean. And this is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster, and earlier in the show, Nathan Weinbender, Murray Pat Truthart, and I discussed nonfiction and Rolling Thunder review of Bob Dylan's story by Martin Scorsese. Let's take this moment to thank Jim Tevin for both producing and engineering the show, and we thank you too, our loyal listeners, and we invite you back next week, same time, same spot, on the radio dial, when we'll again try to separate cinema wheat from cinema chaff. Until then, remember these words from the French writer-philosopher Albert Camus. Fiction is the lie through which we tell the truth. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.